This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. For the past 2 years, no topic has dominated our lives like COVID-19, the respiratory virus that has killed 820,000 Americans and triggered lockdowns at work and school, travel restrictions, vaccine and mask mandates, massive levels of new government spending, and other big and small interventions into our everyday lives. We've also responded to the pandemic with heroic measures, such as the historically fast development and deployment of safe and effective vaccines and therapeutics, and an increasingly healthy skepticism toward state power. In 2020, the first year of COVID, Gallup reported that fully 54% of Americans said that the government should be doing more to solve our problems. That was only the second time in 30 years that a majority called for more state intervention. But after another year and another unpopular president at the helm, the situation has reversed back to historical patterns, with 52% now agreeing that the government is trying to do too many things that should be left to individuals and businesses. But when will the pandemic and all the medical, political, cultural, and economic disruption actually end? I sat down with Reason science correspondent Ronald Bailey and senior editor Jacob Sullum to talk about the uselessness of more lockdowns and mandates in the wake of ubiquitous vaccines, how the politicization of public health has rightly driven down trust in medical experts, the ongoing failure of the FDA and other government agencies to rise to the occasion, and the troubling turn of many people into full-blown anti-vaxxers in the wake of so much misinformation coming from official sources and activists alike. It's a great show and a great way to end the year and look forward, hopefully, to a freer and better 2022. But before I get to the Reason interview with Ronald Bailey and Jacob Sullum, I want to take a moment to introduce today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff, come on, it's just clickbait and fake news that nobody should waste time on. So imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, and I mean positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. And if you go now to Inkle.com/reason, they're going to give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/reason. Inkle.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Ronald Bailey and Jacob Sullum. Ron Bailey, Reason science correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
Jacob Sullum, a longtime senior editor at Reason, thank you for joining.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, we're about to enter kind of the third calendar year of coronavirus, COVID, lockdown, pandemic. And I guess a fair question to ask, and Ron, I'll start with you. You wrote a piece about when do we know when pandemics or, you know, epidemics are over? And what, you know, what that article looked at Reason, that post was about how this is, it's really a social construction of when we know a pandemic is over. So where are we in this and what needs to happen for society, whatever comprises that, to say, okay, you know what, we're done with the coronavirus as a pandemic, that we have reordered virtually every aspect of society. That's over. And now we're going into either going back to normal or into a new way of living with a, you know, a respiratory disease that's going to be around for a while.
Well, I actually think that we're already at the beginning of the end, as it were, of the pandemic, is that more and more people are basically succeeding or seceding from the pandemic, basically saying, well, you know, we've got a better idea of what the risks are for us personally, and we now can calibrate a little bit more, each of us, more of the risks that we want to take. And as that happens, more and more people will be able to leave the pandemic behind over as we go forward into the next year. I tried to set up a benchmark where I thought you would be able to say, well, if it's just as bad as the flu, then that's when it will end, because that's the number of deaths we accept for respiratory diseases typically. And we were very close to that in June, very, very close to that last June. And then Delta came along and we're back up to, 1,300, 1,400 people a day dying from it, which is about, I don't know, four or five times higher than the average daily deaths from flus.
Right. But are we in a place, though, where, you know, since we have widespread vaccines that are, you know, safe and effective, they are free, they're widely available, is it just like, well, you know what, there's a bunch of people out there who are not getting vaccinated, and, you know, that's that. So we should move on. Or, you know, what is the number of daily deaths you think then, where people would say, okay, you know what, we're not putting up with any more restrictions on our behavior other than the, you know, what we choose to get vaccines or not or whatever?
Actually, again, it's kind of puzzling to me because I don't understand why you wouldn't get your vaccination. It's just bizarre to me that there are millions of my fellow Americans who refuse to do that. But they're already acting like there's no pandemic, right? So they've already left the pandemic behind, except it's going to find them, I'm afraid. So the rest of us who are vaccinated, I think that we are slowly but surely coming back to normalcy, that we are feeling safer over time. And I fully expect that by next spring, barring some horrific new variant coming out, that we'll be basically back to what was normal for in commerce and in socializing.
Yeah, Jacob, what's your sense of things? Are we... You know, are we at the end of the pandemic as a kind of medical thing, but nowhere near the end of it as a political thing? How are you feeling about this stuff?
I think it depends on where you live. I mean, in Texas, where I live, it's basically over. We were in Florida. I know Ron chose not to go to Florida. We could maybe talk about that.
Sure. But we were. I was in Florida not too long ago myself.
Yeah, we were in the Florida Keys and in the Miami area. And it's basically over there, too. And just one pretty good indicator is what happens with mask wearing. There was a big controversy last spring when Greg Abbott, Texas's governor, lifted the state requirement for masking. Now, he said at the time, it's still recommended that you do so, but we're not going to force you to it. There won't be any legal penalties. And everybody said this is going to be, not everybody, but his detractors said that this is going to be a disaster. And I didn't think it was going to be a disaster for a number of reasons. I didn't think that the practical impact of the changes that he made, he also eliminated the last of the occupancy limits for businesses. I didn't think that the practical impact would be very dramatic, and therefore it was very unlikely it would have much of an impact on disease trends, which turned out to be true. But also, it did not have an immediate effect on people's behavior, at least in the Dallas area. He lifted this requirement. Businesses continue to require masks. People continue to comply about as well as they'd been complying before. And that lasted for maybe a month, that there really was no discernible difference on the ground. Now, more recently, there's a very, very definite difference. Businesses have changed their policies. I don't know if there's more non-compliance, but few businesses now require it. You know, my own take is it should be up to the business to decide, and I will respect whatever the rule is, even if I don't think it's a sensible rule. I will accept that as a requirement for going in. But most places are not.
But damn it, you're not putting shoes on, right?
I'm not taking my shoes off at the airport, that's for sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
No, I'll have to pry them off.
Shoes and shirts you're still against, but
yes, but the but that, you know, so I think that that's a reasonable approach. Some places now say we recommend it. We recommend it for people who are unvaccinated, whatever. But in terms of actual behavior, you still see a minority of people, both in Florida and in Texas, who are wearing masks. But it's definitely a distinct minority who choose to it when they're not being forced to.
So in places like Florida and Texas, it seems to be over in terms of government mandates on a variety of things. But then in other large population states, such as New York, where I live, and in California, where I'm actually visiting, that's not the case. And Jacob, you recently wrote, the federal government is not going gentle into that good night, right? In terms of just retreating and saying, okay, you know what? Enough people are done with this. We're not going to have mandates on businesses. Can you talk a little bit about the OSHA attempt to, force to mandate vaccines from the federal government to mandate vaccines on businesses that employ more than 100 people? What's going on with that? And then how does that fit into this idea that large parts of the country are saying, screw it, we're done with all this?
Well, that policy was puzzling to begin with in terms of how the Biden administration approached it, because initially they said there was not going to be any kind of general vaccination requirement at the federal level, that they didn't have the authority to do that, and they weren't going to do it. And then they turned around and said, no, we are going to do it. And they couched it as a workplace safety regulation imposed by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. But at the same time, they said the aim is to get more people to be vaccinated in general and to increase the overall, the national vaccination rate. But OSHA does not have the authority to do that. It has the authority specifically to address workplace hazards. So the legal question now is, does this sort of mandate, now just to be clear, it's not strictly speaking a vaccination mandate, because businesses can choose either to require vaccination or to require unvaccinated people to wear masks and be tested regularly. The assumption and the aim is that many businesses will in fact require vaccination, and that will boost the overall vaccination, right? But the justification for it has to be specifically a workplace hazard, not the danger that you will get this disease elsewhere or spread it elsewhere. It has to be workplace specific. And then it has to be because of the method they're using, which avoids the usual rulemaking process and labels this an emergency response, an emergency temporary standard. They have to show, first of all, that there's a grave danger to employees specifically in the workplace. And secondly, that their response or their policy is necessary to address it. So the question is, what do those two things mean? What counts as a grave danger in the workplace? Some workplaces, if you're in a meatpacking plant, the danger of catching or transmitting COVID is much higher than for me, working at home as I have for decades, or in other workplaces that are less crowded with less contact between people. So that varies. And then what does it mean to be necessary? It seems to imply that you have to tailor the policy so that you don't take a broader approach than is necessary. So one of the points that came out in the most recent rounds in the most recent round of litigation over this is that OSHA is saying, if you are vaccinated, then you don't face a grave danger from COVID in the workplace. And if you're unvaccinated, then you do. But if you look at the numbers, a young person who's unvaccinated may face the same risk as an older person who's vaccinated. So really, logically, it doesn't make any sense. So that's one of the points that's going to be contested. It's going to come down mainly to the question of whether the statute that OSHA is relying on actually authorizes this order, whether they meet the criteria laid out in the statute. And then there are secondary questions having to do with, is this constitutional? First question is whether Congress would have the authority to impose a rule like this. Under current precedents, probably yes.
Yeah, I mean, they can pretty much do whatever they want.
It should not, but probably the answer would be yes. Whether Congress actually authorized OSHA to do something like this, and whether, assuming that it did, it could do that, which is an issue of how much lawmaking responsibility you can delegate to administrative agencies. That's a more contentious issue. But I would just one other thing I would add is that the other bizarre thing about the Biden administration's approach to this is that I mentioned they reversed themselves in terms of whether they were going to require impose a general vaccine mandate. they continue to say, or the last time Biden addressed the issue, he said he does not have the authority to impose a general mask mandate. You know, they require them on airplanes and other modes of transportation, you know, within federal buildings, that sort of thing. But there is no general requirement. And he has said he does not have the authority to do that, which is weird because the CDC, you may recall, imposed a moratorium, a nationwide moratorium on evictions based on the premise that if people had to move, they might move into situations where they're more likely to catch the virus. And their reading of the law implied that they could do literally anything as long as they thought it was necessary or appropriate to limit the spread of communicable disease, and not just COVID. It could be the cold, it could be seasonal flu. And under that understanding of law, the administration definitely would have the authority to require everyone to wear masks in public places, and it could also impose national lockdowns and all the rest. So I think Biden is kind of schizophrenic when it comes to what he thinks is the federal government's authority, and specifically the president's authority, or the authority for administrative agencies to address communicable diseases.
Isn't this a big part of the specifically libertarian response to the way the government has been acting at state levels and at local levels, but especially at the federal level, where it seems like, the government agencies, and whether it's the FDA or CDC, and I want to talk about FDA approval of therapeutics and whatnot in a little bit, but they're always reversing themselves. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth. Somebody like Joe Biden does not inspire a lot of confidence. I mean, he has Trump-level disapproval ratings at this point. But Jacob, is that part of the issue? It's not even about what is a good course of action or not, or whether or not individuals should be free to choose things. It's just that the government at all levels is using this just to massively expand their ability to structure our everyday life.
I would give them, I guess, more credit than that. I think they're sincere. It is, in a sense, encouraging that Biden bothered to even think about what was legally allowed or not, right? He at least paid lip service to that idea that even though a policy might be desirable, that doesn't make it legal or constitutional necessarily. So that's a bit encouraging. But then on the other hand, he has a very wide understanding of what the executive branch and the federal government in general can do when it comes to trying to, control the spread of COVID-19. And I just want a further example of that, which I was just writing about today, is the CDC has issued guidance, which is officially voluntary. It's not mandatory, right? For for K-12 schools in particular, saying all schools should require universal masking, meaning students, no matter what age, teachers, no matter whether they're vaccinated or not, everybody has to wear a mask throughout the day. And even though that's officially voluntary in court, these lawsuits are arguing that it is effectively legally required, because if you don't mandate masks in schools, you are discriminating against people with disabilities. And that's an argument that the Biden administration has endorsed. So the implication of that would be is that whatever the CDC thinks is appropriate for schools is actually mandatory. And it wouldn't just be masking. It would be whatever else they recommend in terms of physical distancing or improved ventilation or whatever. Whatever they say is appropriate in order to reduce the risk of disease transmission becomes mandatory under that legal theory. And that's pretty bold, because there's, that gives this one agency that is known to issue policies that don't have a firm scientific basis to reverse those policies on a dime without much of a sensible justification, and to impose, really absurd restrictions on people, or recommend absurd restrictions on people. You may recall the recommendations for summer camps, where kids who were outside playing sports were supposed to be wearing masks all the time. And it was just crazy in terms of the science underlying it. There was no empirical support for that recommendation. And just in terms of how practical that is and how really cruel it is, to say that the kids should be forced to do that. So imagine if it not only had the power to make recommendations like that were absurd and widely condemned, but to make those mandatory as well.
Ron, you have, through the course of the pandemic, you have been more favorable, I guess, or more comfortable with certain types of government mandates and edicts and things like that. How do you pick apart the point where something that is actually in the public health, you know, goes from being that at the lowest level of kind of coercion to an overreach that seems to be now, you know, kind of on perpetual motion or something like that, where, you know, I mean, it's comforting to think that in many parts of the country, people and governments are done with the, you know, with lockdowns and pandemic measures, but, you know, they're really not. So how do you suss out the difference between a good, you know, how do you evaluate a policy that is actually good from a public health perspective and is least invasive in terms of screwing with the way people go about their business? And then these policies that seem to keep continuing regardless of science or the actual threat being presented.
Well, I want to agree with you and Jacob. Our public health authorities have gone into way overreach right now. But the thing is, if you're going to have public health at all, it's going to be addressing communicable diseases. And I would argue that that's what the CDC was set up to do, you know, 60, 70 years ago, and they've gone completely crazy as it is now. But, you know, it takes a while for us to figure out things. And this is, I was initially more in favor of things like lockdowns and that kind of thing at the beginning of the pandemic, because we really didn't have a good sense of the risk at that point. We were looking at what was happening in China, and those horrific images out of Italy and so forth. And so an initial flattening the curve notion seemed very reasonable to me as an initial step. Then we got well beyond flattening the curve. We managed to flatten the curve fairly successfully, but then it became, now nobody ever gets COVID ever again. And that was not what the risk was supposed to be. Basically, I view what happened in March and April of 2020 as a learning experience where the rest of us and our public health officials as well were figuring out what the actual risks were, and then we could decide how comfortable we would be with regard to, you know, going about our daily lives, doing commerce, what have you. I think so that initial response was reasonable, but now they've gone well beyond what we would call a reasonable response at this point.
Can we talk a bit about specifically among the libertarian community? Because, you know, obviously Reason is a libertarian organization, and, you know, we cover this kind of stuff. How do you guys feel? Like, I'm assuming, and I should actually ask, you're both vaccinated. You both believe in the efficacy and the safety of the vaccines, right?
I'm vaccinated, boosted. I'm ready to go.
I'm as vaccinated as I possibly can be. And I actually got my first dose early before it was officially authorized for me by going to a little town near Dallas where they had extra doses left over. You know, once they opened the vial, they had to get rid of them all. Some people didn't show up for their appointments or whatever. So I got one of those, which means I also was eligible for boosters relatively early. Yeah, so for me that was a no-brainer. I was at the time when they first started, studying and then approving the vaccines. Some people were like, I don't know about the risks and the dangers. And what I was like, I will take it now. Give it to me now. I will take it now. Why wouldn't you? You know, it's very, very clear that the benefits, you know, far outweigh the hazards.
Yeah. So, you know, and why don't we start with you, Ron? How do you deal with, there's a sizable number of people who are libertarian, call themselves libertarian, who are not simply anti-mandate. And I consider myself in this camp where, you know, for a disease like COVID, I don't think that mandates are necessary. If you're talking about something like smallpox, which, you know, has a death rate or an infection fatality rate of 30%, something like 30% of the, you know, the people who get it are going to die. You know, for COVID, it's less than 1%. And depending on your demographic, it's essentially, you know, zero. But what do you think is going on within the libertarian community? Because it seems to me that many people are not simply anti-mandate, but they're anti-vaccine. And it's kind of growing backwards from their anti-this vaccine for some of the reasons that Jacob was talking about, that, oh, this is a new technology. It's not proven. I want to wait and see. To actually being anti, like, all vaccines and any mandate for a vaccine for a communicable disease. What do you think is going on there?
I have no clue. I think of libertarians as people being techno-optimistic, that they trust in human creativity and innovation to come up with solutions to problems like the communicable disease of COVID-19. And I would have thought that they would be the first people as an ideological group to embrace the new technologies and to take responsibility for protecting themselves, their friends, and their family, and go to get the vaccine. So I sometimes think that a lot of people who call themselves libertarians don't quite understand what the word means, that they're basically contrarians, that they no one is the boss of me kind of people, and that's fine as a libertarian viewpoint, but also what libertarians want is a society of free and responsible individuals. And I'm thinking that a lot of the people who are anti-vax in the libertarian movement, if you could call them that, are in fact failing to understand that they're supposed to be responsible, that they want to be among other citizens and their fellow Americans to protect themselves and their family.
Yeah, Jacob, what do you think?
I mean, I think Ron is probably right that there is this element of, if the government says it's good, it's probably bad. There's something to that as a rule of thumb. So, but it can be overused, that rule of thumb. Sometimes what the government says is good actually is good. And you kind of have to exercise some judgment and look at the evidence before you come to a conclusion. The more puzzling thing to me actually is what's up with Republicans or self-described conservatives who are so vehemently against the vaccine, despite the fact that they're fans of Trump, and that was like his biggest accomplishment. Now he recently gave he delivered a couple of remarks, basically saying what's true, which is that we did this much faster than anybody ever expected. We should get credit for that. This saved tens of millions of lives around the world, and you're playing into our enemies' hands by bashing vaccines. Every time he says something like that, he gets some boos. And that's pretty striking. So what that says to me is that it's not him. He's to the extent that he downplayed the value of vaccination, he was catering to what he perceived to be the wishes of his supporters. In other words, it's coming more from them than from him. Because every time he tries to say, this is something we should be proud of, this is one of my administration's biggest accomplishments, he gets booed. And he has to actually say, oh, okay, some people feel that way. No, he makes a point of saying it shouldn't be mandatory, which I agree with, actually. It shouldn't be mandated. But more recently, he said, this is of great value, not just, oh, it might work, it might not work kind of thing, which is really stupid, when he has said things like that. So that's very striking to me. I really don't understand it. The people that I have talked to who are anti or against the COVID-19 vaccines tend to be against vaccines in general, tend to be into alternative medicine, and you can't reason with them. I mean, you cannot present evidence and expect them to be at all open to it or to be, let alone be persuaded by it. And so you just kind of have to change the subject because you don't make any headway. And so if you ask me, for among the Americans who haven't been vaccinated, who are actually firmly opposed to it, as opposed to on the fence or not quite persuaded yet or whatever, I honestly don't know what argument. I don't think they're open to argument or evidence. If they were, they wouldn't take that position. So it's kind of, I don't, you say, what kind of information or arguments can you use? I don't think you can. I don't think they work.
Ron, two points, if I may, very quickly. One is that it would have been much more helpful if Trump at the beginning, back in December and January of last year, had come out in favor of the vaccine and gotten himself shot up on television or something. Sure. But no, he wouldn't do that. But the other thing is that I'm really puzzled by this, is the people who are against the vaccines. What is it that they think that, old, rich, white people were so anxious for, to run out and get it? If you would think that everybody would want old, rich, white people getting the vaccine would be an indication that this was good stuff. So you should go get it. But instead, you don't see that out there. I'm very puzzled by that.
Ron, part of it is also the, again, the overreach. I mean, living in New York City, I can remember, early on in this in 2020, both Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio, who hate each other, even if they're both Democrats, but they literally one week they were saying, hey, go out, live your life. We can't let this overtake things. Businesses need patrons, go out and drink and eat and all of that. And then the next week they were defining what was and was not an essential business and kind of futzing around with that. you know, how much of the response is just the idea that the people who are in charge are kind of idiots, you know, which I think is true of Biden, of Trump, of Cuomo, of Bill de Blasio, and, you know, many other, you know, governors and mayors around the country. And, you know, that people end up just taking a very reactionary mode of, I mean, I guess you were talking about that when you're saying, I'm not the boss of me. And if that's the case, then what do you do to kind of disentangle, you know, understanding why you don't want to do anything that Andrew Cuomo or Donald Trump tells you, but also like you should think about, you know, what's actually better for you as an individual?
Well, obviously, what you should be doing is reading Reason Magazine and the wonderful articles that Jacob and I are writing. But basically, what you have to do is evaluate the evidence that's out there. And there's plenty, you know, there are, it's not that difficult to do for most people. And I would think that, yes, you had a lot of flip-flopping, a lot of the messages early on in COVID were, you know, completely incoherent to some extent.
And they were being countermanded every, you know, exactly. Every couple of weeks or something like that. And then you had, I mean, to, you know, be fully upfront about all of this too, you had people like Anthony Fauci, who is, you know, the main point guy in all of this, admitting at various points that he lied about, you know, what he thought was the efficacy of masks, of, you know, the percentage needed for herd immunity and things like that.
Right. And of course, what we've done is set up a situation where if we really get another communicable disease that with much worse outcomes coming, that listening to public health officials people will simply tune them out for a long time. And we're putting ourselves at greater risk because our public health officials did not behave responsibly, I would argue.
Yeah. Jacob, you have written a lot over the years about public health as a concept. And, you know, public health ultimately is it's a way of looking at populations from cost-benefit analyses where, you know, is this a behavior or is a disease or some kind of situation, is it going to hurt more people than it helps? And then how do you kind of respond to that as a society? And it obviously, at various points, it definitely conflicts with kind of basic libertarian ideas of giving people as much autonomy as possible. How do you rate the way that the public health model has been applied during COVID? And, you know, what do you see as the greatest? And I guess, first off, can you talk about the libertarian case for a public health perspective? And then what were the biggest moments where, you know, governments at whatever level really overstepped bounds?
Yes. Well, I mean, the problem with public health as it's currently conceived is that it encompasses anything that people do that might be bad. I think that's fair to say. It doesn't even have to be an increased risk of disease or injury, although that's a big part of it. But for example, gambling has been conceived as a public health issue, right?
Yeah, people have talked about climate change as a public health.
And, you know, certainly any lifestyle choice that increases your risk of disease or injury can be conceived of and has been conceived of as a public health issue, meaning it's the government's responsibility to address it, which opens the door to all sorts of policies ranging from the relatively mild, like nagging people, to very severe policies like we have with drug prohibition, where you actually ban the thing that you're worried about. And that to me is fundamentally misconceived, at least, you know, from a classical liberal point of view. The legitimate role for government is to protect you from external threats. And in the case of public health, that means something like COVID-19 or something like smallpox, where you have carriers of a disease that represents a threat to you. And the government has a legitimate role in stepping in and trying to reduce that risk. And those interventions might be very severe. So in the case of smallpox, you might require people to be vaccinated. And that was upheld by the Supreme Court when it was imposed at the state and local level. And that's a pretty severe interference with your freedom because they're making you put something into your body that you would otherwise not put in your body. But to carry over that grant of authority to all of these other areas where you're not posing a danger to other people, you're not violating anyone's rights, you're posing a threat to yourself at most, to use that as a license for government intervention is a recipe for totalitarianism, right? It's all a question of where you stop. taken to its logical conclusion, it means that the government can regulate every choice you make in life in order to minimize morbidity and mortality for the population as a whole. And so just to illustrate the contrast between what I take to be a legitimate target for public health authorities and all these other targets, before the pandemic, one of the big causes that the CDC took up was vaping, and how vaping was bad. And in particular, they implied it was bad because it would cause these serious lung injuries, which they implied was associated with legal nicotine vaping, or quasi-legal, I guess I should say, nicotine vaping. But in fact, it turned out it was related to black market THC vapes that were contaminated with this chemical that apparently caused these injuries. So that, if anything, shows you the hazards of creating a black market by banning certain things, right? But the CDC was implying that, if you switch from smoking to vaping, it's actually more dangerous, that this is something that might kill you right now, as opposed to might, kill you in a few decades. And that's just crazy from two perspectives. One is that it's not it shouldn't be the purview of the government to be involved in habits that pose risks to the people who engage in them. And secondly, even if you accept that premise that this is a legitimate public health issue, it's completely the wrong position to take, because you want to encourage people to do less hazardous forms of any given drug habit. So if you're getting your nicotine from vaping rather than smoking cigarettes, the hazards are much, much lower. And if you extrapolate that to the whole population, you're talking about substantially fewer smoking-related deaths over the long term. That's something that the public health people are supposed to be concerned about. So they were wrong-headed in at least two major ways. Now they switch gears from that sort of thing to, issuing guidance about an actual public health issue, which is this communicable disease. So already they're starting with a handicap, because so many people had grown to mistrust agencies like the CDC because they had interpreted their authority or their purview so broadly, and had become paternalists who are trying to protect you from yourself. There are a lot of people, me included, who were resistant to any advice coming from those authorities because we had learned to discount it over the years. And then I will say, once they actually got into the area that they actually should be involved in, they screwed it up in a lot of ways, many of which Ron has written about. But one of the most striking things to me is just the amount of misinformation and misleading presentations of the scientific literature. The current head of the CDC, the previous head did this too, but the current head has over and over again said things that either are just not so, or that are highly misleading.
What's an example of that? What's like the prime example of that?
Well, most recently, she's been talking about the case for requiring universal masking in K-12 schools. And she implies that there's lots of research showing that this works, that it has an important impact on virus transmission. And in fact, there's almost no research that supports that. There is the research that she's talking about they go and look at schools that are doing basically what the CDC says they should do. And they look and they say, well, what's the disease transmission like? Oh, it's pretty low. It's either about what it is in the community or even lower than what it is in the community. That doesn't prove anything about the efficacy of any of those policies, let alone a specific one, because they're not comparing it to other, other schools that are doing things differently. That is the bulk of the research. There are only a few studies that actually compare schools with mask mandates, schools that don't have them. And in those cases, you still have to control for other, possible confounding variables, which they have to date have not done. So she and the CDC more generally systematically exaggerates the strength of the evidence for this policy they've already decided on. They've already decided this is what everybody should do. And then after the fact, they're trying to collect research that will, retroactively validate that decision. That kind of thing, I think, is not good for their credibility, even when they're talking about the sorts of things they should be talking about.
Would you say that the prime mistake then, kind of in the public health model as it's been applied to COVID, Jacob, is that the government has a right to kind of restrict certain types of behaviors in a pandemic, in some kind of public health emergency? Is it that they went from saying, here are here are procedures or protocols that every business or school or individual should follow. And if you follow these, you can open. They went from that to saying things like, this is an essential business, this is a non-essential business, no school can open, et cetera. So, I mean, is it that they're not wrong to issue dictates during COVID? It's the specific things they were doing were just beyond what a limited government should be able to do.
Well, I think it comes down to costs versus benefits. And they were flying blind, certainly early in the pandemic. They didn't know what the benefits were, and they didn't know what the costs were. We still don't have, you know, a full accounting of either of those. But an important thing that was, you know, I think initially everybody was in panic mode and they did not sufficient consideration to the costs of these policies. I think that's fair to say. And then in terms of evaluating after the fact, did this work? You have to distinguish between voluntary changes in behavior, which were happening before lockdowns were imposed, and any additional changes that were accomplished because of these government policies, right? And lockdown defenders generally don't do that. But in order to say whether the policy worked or whether it was cost effective, you have to do that. You have to ask, did it actually prevent deaths or did it merely postpone deaths? You have to ask something that Andrew Cuomo never wanted to do, who is dying from COVID? And if it is overwhelmingly elderly people, not to say that doesn't matter, we shouldn't care about it, but it is not as bad as what happened, say, during the Spanish flu pandemic, when you had young people in the prime of life and children dying routinely from this disease. That cost is greater. That sort of cost is greater. And so if you're weighing, you know, how much is it worth in terms of economic loss, and also there's a you know, a loss in terms of life from these policies. You know, you have these skyrocketing drug-related deaths, many of which are probably equivalent to suicides, although they're not counted as such during the pandemic. Now, and a lot of that has to do with the government policies. You have deaths that could have been prevented by medical procedures that were, you know, temporarily banned or the access to them was restricted, right? So you even have a loss in terms of lives from these policies, but certainly in terms of quality of life, psychological health, education, which has long-term, you know, economic implications, and all of the, you know, the costs imposed on businesses. So you have, taking those into account, you have to say, what was the benefit? And how do we evaluate the benefit? You know, how do we assign a dollar value to it? Because you have to do that. And how do we assign a dollar value to the costs? And which was greater? And even if the benefits of the lockdowns by this under your calculation were greater than the costs, that still doesn't mean it was a good policy, because maybe you could have achieved the same benefit or something very close to it through less restrictive policies at a lower cost, targeted policies that focus most on people who are at highest risk. And the honest answer is we don't really know. We don't really know what the upshot of that calculation would be. But for sure, in the heat of the moment when they're imposing these policies, they have no idea. They have no idea what they're doing. So the question then becomes, where, you know, in which direction do you err? Do you err on the side of let's do something because it might work? Or do you say, Jesus, this is a really major disruption to the economy and people's lives, maybe we should err on the side of not doing it. You know, that, and that the answer to that depends on, you know, people's values.
Right. And we know that, you know, clearly the government, both under Trump and under Biden, is erring in a non-libertarian direction. Ron, you wrote recently about Pfizer finally getting an approval on a COVID therapeutic from the FDA. Very quickly, you know, If there's one thing that I think, you know, libertarians have been harping on for as long as they've existed and as long as the FDA has existed, is that this is a lumbering bureaucratic organization. Could you talk about why it took so long for the FDA to authorize this particular thing, as well as the vaccines, as well as other issues? Like, do a 30-second, you know, solo on how badly the FDA has behaved in the past 2 years.
The FDA has basically not treated the COVID epidemic as an emergency. They've been very slow at approving things. The good news is, with regard to the vaccines, they could have approved them much earlier. They could have streamlined the system so that you could have evaluated them on a rolling basis. For example, the Pfizer vaccine was approved in Europe well ahead of its approval here. We could have done that. We didn't do that. I've been harping on testing since March of 2020, and that as a way of being able to help give people information so that they could manage their risks and their health and protect other people.
And that's the idea of reliable, easy to get, home at test so that you know when you're going out whether or not you might have COVID.
And, but let's not rehearse how they screwed up the testing at the beginning of it in the first place. But they didn't approve at-home tests, but two of them up until this past October, and they were not widely available in this country at all. And all of a sudden in October, they said, oh, well, hey, we've got five others, and they approved five more at that point. Why did they wait basically a year and a half to get around to approving at-home tests? Because it's amazing. I was in Scotland covering the climate change conference, and I was being handed free COVID tests on the street. And so I actually imported 28 of them home to us. And this is kind of the way we should have been setting it up. They've been treating COVID tests as though there's some sort of therapeutic. You know, the fact is they're a diagnostic. If it's a little bit wrong, you're not going to die from using it, but it might give you a signal about what your risks are. And that was, it's just been completely maddening. With regard to the antiviral therapeutics, the Pfizer pill, for example. Again, there were rolling data coming in over time, and the FDA could have decided to approve this at least a month or two, probably ahead of where it was in fact approved. It's just been kind of maddening how they've lumbered along and allowed essentially the pandemic to proceed where they could have more effectively and more quickly intervened and helped a lot of people, and they just haven't.
Yeah, and there doesn't seem to be any groundswell to actually fundamentally restructure the org. I mean, you know, at least after 9/11, and it's not like it worked out well, but things like immigration and, you know, national security were revamped, revisited. So, Jacob, you've written a lot about the FDA and its kind of both its overreach and its incompetency. Do you see any, you know, what would be the best way to actually spur reform of the FDA and also of groups like the CDC beyond just saying we need to abolish them?
I mean, I think that in an emergency, even if you think the regular procedures that the FDA follows either don't make sense or do make sense, regardless of what you think about the regular procedures, in an emergency, there's a very strong case for not taking the usual approach. You may recall, you know, there were a series of decisions where they're going to approve something, but they have to schedule a meeting first, right? And then, you know, the advisor council has to weigh in, and then they have another meeting, and it's like, well, you know, so maybe in that case, maybe you're talking about a week or two, but that's real, you know, that has a significant cost when you're dealing with the communicable disease that's killing people every day.
And they took Thanksgiving off, in 2020. They were like, well, we'll get to it, but, you know, we got the Thanksgiving, and everybody's looking forward to Thanksgiving, so let's push it back a couple of weeks.
So, I mean, ideally, what you would see, we didn't, is that as in other areas of regulation, the standard rules would have been relaxed, and then we would have seen, oh, that worked pretty well. Maybe some of these rules don't make that much sense. So there would be a carryover. Now, there was one good example that, by the way, is alcohol regulation at the state level. Where lots of these rules that never made sense to begin with were relaxed, and many of those changes are staying with us. So that's a sort of a positive development where the government learned from what was tolerated during an emergency, maybe it could also be tolerated when you're not in an emergency. The FDA, I don't think, doesn't seem to be learning that lesson at all. It hasn't even, you know, for the most part, suspended these rules during the emergency, let alone carried that over to ordinary times. So I'm not at all, you know, hopeful for that stuff. I would, you know, ideally like to see a narrowing of the authority of agencies like the CDC and the FDA so that they deal more with things that are actually connected to, you know, either, you know, in the case of CDC, communicable diseases, or in the case of the FDA, preventing things like, you know, poisoning people, right? Having poison in your food. You know, that's not right. You shouldn't be poisoned. If you sell something that's supposed to be food and it's actually poison, you know, that's not right. And you know, I think it's a legitimate role for the government in preventing that sort of thing. But in terms of deciding what, you know, will vaping be allowed? And if so, can you have flavors other than tobacco? It is completely insane that they're even involved in that. They should have nothing to do with that. You know, there should be rules against fraud so that the people selling these vaping products can't make claims that they can't back up, and against, you know, misrepresenting the contents, that sort of thing. And the problem with that, but making these broader decisions based on a sort of collectivist calculus of how you think it's going to affect the population as a whole during the next, you know, several decades, which no one can really do it anyway, seems insane. The question should be left up, you know, to the individual consumer to say, are the potential benefits of this product, you know, do they outweigh the risks for me? For me, that's the question that should count. It shouldn't be up to some central authority to weigh the cost of benefits for all of society.
You know, you both mentioned earlier that in this conversation that you had trips to Florida planned. And Ron, you canceled yours because of the Omicron variant. Jacob, you went ahead with yours. Just, you know, as a kind of small thing of, you know, we're all libertarians here. You know, Ron, what went into the calculus of saying, you know, we're going to cancel our trip? What was your kind of personal cost benefit analysis to say, okay, we're either going or we're not?
Right. Well, it was at the very beginning of the Omicron. And again, we weren't getting the data out of the UK or South Africa at the time of basically how severe that particular version of the virus was. And both Pamela and I are fully vaccinated and fully boosted. And we're basically saying, you know, well, we could probably be okay. Then we thought about it this way is, well, if we get down there and we test positive, how do we get home? And that was basically it as well. That's really hard to figure that out. So why take the risk anyway? And we'll go to Florida next year.
Yeah. Assuming it's still there, right?
Assuming it's still there.
Yeah. Jacob, what about you? Because you were going on a family vacation. So, you know, how do you calculate all of that?
All right. So we're all as vaccinated as we can be. My main concern through the pandemic has been my wife, because she takes a medication that suppresses her immune system. So she is in a high risk group. I've been more cautious than certainly many people we know, maybe most people we know, and even more cautious than she has been to tell you the truth, and it really should be up to her. But in this case, she actually planned the trip, which told me she thought it was okay, the risks were tolerable. And, you know, we were not in any tight indoor situations with lots of, you know, that were crowded with lots of people. That did not happen at all. We were outdoors most of the time when we weren't in like our own, you know, hotel room or whatever. I did go to a sparsely visited tiki bar in Key West, but I would be uncomfortable in a really jam-packed bar even if I didn't have to worry about the communicable diseases. So we didn't do any of that. And to me, it's quite unlikely in any of the settings we visited that you would catch the virus, even if we weren't vaccinated. Just given the odds and the amount of time and the physical setup, of the places we visited, you know, there was a chance, no question. We took a chance, but if it was tolerable for my wife, I figured it should be tolerable for the rest of us too.
Ron, you had mentioned earlier about that shift that went on, and it was kind of unremarked upon in the media, certainly, except at places like Reason, where early on it was, okay, how many people are being hospitalized and dying? And then it became, we have to go to zero COVID. We need to stop all infections. Why should we be worried about the infection rate, you know, as opposed to serious outcomes? Because it's, you know, we seem to be at a moment now where, you know, being vaccinated doesn't mean you won't get COVID, right. Although it does reduce the chances. But it does pretty much wipe out the chances of you getting it and then having serious outcomes. So isn't it kind of mission accomplished in a very profound way?
I agree with you. I think it is more or less mission accomplished with regard to those of us who are vaccinated. Again, it would be much more pleasant. I'll have to say this because I've been working at home and travel has been curtailed to some extent.
Although you did go on at least one envy-inducing trip. Yeah, that I saw in your Instagram feed. So screw you, but go ahead.
But, well, in those days, the Omicron variant wasn't out. But I guess what I was trying to get up to basically saying is it's been very pleasant for the fact that I've had not a single bad cold in 2 years. For the first time since I, you know, was a kid, it's kind of amazing. But you know, is that worth it? I think that I'm being incoherent here. I think that I will be, as I say, I think that the pandemic will be over for me and for the rest of the country come this spring, essentially. Again, if there's not a more horrible variant out there waiting to emerge.
So let's talk, just as a final point of conversation, let's talk about what the long-term effects of the pandemic and the policies that it inspired or enabled. You know, when you go back and you look at the Spanish flu or the 1918 flu epidemic, one of the things that John Barry, the historian of that pandemic, talks a lot about is that within a couple of years, it seemed to have receded completely from public memory and collective consciousness. He says, you know, there's virtually no plays, no songs, no books, no movies, no anything about the epidemic, which was far worse than what we're in now. It was coming at the end of World War I. It came just before a major economic expansion. But you know, Jacob, why don't you start? What do you think the long-term kind of social, cultural, political implications of this will be? And maybe with a particular eye, because you have a couple of young kids, you know, for children, you know, because they have in a lot of ways, they were the least likely to have any outcome, bad outcome from all of this, but their lives were in many ways more disrupted than any other sectors. But what do you think we'll learn from or we'll remember from the, you know, the past 2 years and possibly the next 20?
I mean, I guess my hope is that people would be appropriately skeptical of government policies and information from the government. And I say appropriately skeptical because if they're skeptical in the sense that they reject vaccines, you know, that's not a good
thing. Yeah, I mean, there's nihilism and there's skepticism, right?
Reasonable. Yeah. But, you know, I think this certainly should apply to lots of people who own small businesses, for example, or people lost jobs, you know, during the pandemic, that they saw very clearly what the costs of those policies were. But, you know, we still don't know what the benefit was for sure. And if over the course of a few more years of research, we don't have a persuasive, if not conclusive case that the benefits of those restrictions outweigh the costs, I would think that the people who experience those costs most directly would be more skeptical of government's proposed solutions to anything that's depicted as a crisis, not necessarily, you know, a pandemic. That's sort of my hope. My fear is that, especially with younger people, that they might become accustomed to the idea that the government can exercise these sort of quasi-dictatorial powers in response to an emergency. This was for an emergency. We'll have more emergencies in the future. You know, you could have a life that's just filled with these sort of rolling emergencies that justify what are no longer extraordinary exercises of power, but just sort of standard operating procedure. I don't think that adults will respond to it that way because they remember what it was like beforehand and they understood the transition. But younger kids might, that if that's mostly what they've known. So there, I have a hope and a fear. I don't have any firm predictions because my predictions I don't have a good track record with my predictions.
Basically what Jacob said, but I would add one other thing. I'm afraid that this particular episode has created and is fueling a much stronger anti-vaccination movement across the United States. And I'm afraid that this is going to become more of a problem over time. But basically, a lot of the health benefits that we've gotten from previous vaccines will be squandered because people will simply stop using the old vaccines, much less the current ones that we have, the current COVID ones that we have. I'm very much afraid that anti-vaccination forces have been encouraged.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. This has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, featuring science correspondent Ron Bailey of Reason and senior editor Jacob Sullum, also of Reason. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on every service. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.